DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, your one-stop shop for all the latest in science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, a top-ranking police commissioner throws light on the dark side of gaming as the streets of Sydney get more violent.
The one thing that I know has changed is the access that young people particularly have to these violent games where they live out their fantasies to some extent, and I think that rewires their brain to the point where they actually sometimes can't differentiate between reality and fantasy.
Also on the programme, shaping up with the Grinberg method and why music's louder than ever. All that and more right here on Spectrum.
It's one small step for man, one
Neil Armstrong, who has died at the age of 82, uttering one of the shortest sentences on Earth, but perhaps one of the most lasting too. The quality of the sound recording is perhaps as famous as the words themselves. Uttered as Armstrong became the world's first person to set foot on the lunar surface in July 1969. While his co-astronaut, Buzz Aldrin, quickly became the second man on the moon, few have truly followed in Armstrong's first steps. The moon landing was watched around the world in a very real TV extravaganza, but that coverage was only possible with the help of a little-known tracking station in Australia called Honeysuckle Creek. Well, let's say it's little-known outside of Australia. And many still think that the American space agency NASA did it all from the States. But in fact, the very first television pictures, and with it the audio, came through Honeysuckle Creek near Canberra. And there on the day of the first moon landing was John Saxon, operations supervisor at Honeysuckle Creek. Saxon met Armstrong twice before he died and is called the very private astronaut an incredible human being. I asked him why.
I had a bit of a think about this as I've been talking to a few people, and I came to the conclusion that we all meet plenty of prominent people in our lifetime, one way or another, and in our presumptuous way, we think, oh, if circumstances had been different, I could probably done that and I could be famous too. But when you meet an astronaut, and I met plenty, you never ever feel that. Those are incredible human beings, marvelous at their work, wonderful in many ways. And Neil Armstrong was the top of the heap. He was the ultimate astronaut, marvelously cool in a crisis, and just a great human being as well. It's just so sad that he's gone.
And was he also fearless, from what we gather? I mean, the early astronauts are said to have been a little more adventurous, maybe. Is that true of Neil Armstrong?
I think it was true of all the astronauts at that time. I mean, Kennedy had set this goal of landing people on the moon and hopefully getting them back to Earth before the end of the decade, of 1969. And they certainly admitted that the chances of them having a successful mission on Apollo 11 was probably only 50%. I think Apollo 8 was probably the most gutsy mission of them all, but Apollo 11, because you add the landing into that, makes it an exceptional mission.
It was a very difficult landing, and if we compare it to what we just saw with the Mars landing, Apollo 11 had, if I can say it, far inferior technology compared to what we see now, but they still managed.
Yes, but I think the difference was that you had men up there who could react to circumstances probably better than most machines could, and even though the technology was ridiculously old-fashioned by current standards, the mission was well understood, and there was a good chance they might make it, but there was a better chance that they would not kill themselves in the effort, I think.
And of course, if I can put it this way, famously, Neil Armstrong almost did die on three occasions, and yet he maintained a very private persona, didn't he?
That's right. I think he felt that he was just doing his job, and he's an engineer who happened to be in the right place at the right time. I don't think it was quite that easy. I think there was a lot of thought went into having him to be the first man to walk on the moon if possible. I think he was by far the best choice, to be honest, a civilian and not a military man, and such a cool customer. I mean, here he was taking off in the Saturn V rocket, the biggest rocket ever made that anybody's flown in, going off to the moon, and he's got a heart rate of 84 beats per minute. I do that coming up my front steps. Okay, he was doing 116 beats per minute. I've got copies of that traces. We monitored all this. We were required to. When he stepped onto the moon, he was doing 116, which was pretty high for him, but nevertheless very low for the majority of us.
And that was part of the data that you were trying to collect, wasn't it? More than just whether people could land on the moon, it was stuff like that, wasn't it? How humans reacted in that environment.
Well, you know that you might have known that there was discussion within NASA before Apollo 8 that whether or not they should take television to the lunar surface, if it could be developed in time, whether it was too much of a hassle for the astronauts. I mean, the people who subscribe to hoax theories would be really impressed if they hadn't taken a TV camera with them.
So, well, maybe that's the double trick.
The TV was not the most important data, though. The most important data by far was the astronauts' biomedical data, the heartbeats, respiration, suit temperatures and pressures and oxygen levels and all the rest of it. That was the important data. TV was most definitely secondary. Actually, it was probably about a third-order priority, really.
And, John Sexton, you must have been, well, obviously, a little preoccupied by the operation that was unfolding in front of you at Honeysuckle Creek. But what was it like for you, or what was the atmosphere like at Honeysuckle Creek? I mean, you saw these great pictures coming in before the rest of the world.
Well, it was pretty tense, but, you know, we'd had a lot of tense simulations, dozens of them, and we were really pleased to see things more or less going according to plan. Had we sat and thought, you know, 20% of the world's population is watching this, we might have been a little more concerned, but as it was, I listened to those tapes and I think, well, how brash, and we just took it all in our stride.
John Sexton, who was the operations supervisor at Honeysuckle Creek in Australia on the day of the 1969 moon landing, remembering US astronaut Neil Armstrong, who has died.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
The games industry has lately changed as much as gamers themselves. We're almost all at it, non-stop and everywhere, playing on consoles, handhelds and phones. It's opened up new possibilities for the big publishers as well as some small independent developers in Europe. Guillaume Correa de Silva reports.
320-something gamers can take their eyes off the iPhone screen. One of them is trying out a new game. He asks the guy next to him whether he'd made the game himself, and Patrick Schindler nods in agreement. The 28-year-old developed the game together with a colleague. It took them a year. They designed it on their own, without the support of a big games company. Patrick worked before as a character artist for a German firm, but he was not having fun at his job anymore. So he decided to take a risk and press the reset button.
I couldn't imagine now at the moment to work in a big studio anymore. Because I didn't really like this day-to-day job anymore. Actually, for me, it's all about just freedom. Freedom to, in my day-to-day work, when I can work. I mean, I can work from home and work with my buddy. And freedom, which kind of game I do, or which kind of art.
So Patrick and his colleagues started working on their own. They had an advantage, though, in that they already had some experience in the field. The two decided to create a simple game for people to have fun on the go. Their idea was based around a fish swimming in an ocean full of obstacles. It wasn't out of the blue that they chose to make a game for the iPhone, Patrick says.
So many developers are now starting up on iPhone because it's so much easier. The level of entrance is really low, so everybody really can just go in, develop a game for really very few money. Don't really have to make a big effort for mobile games, because many people playing mobile games are on the run, just playing a few minutes on the bus or whatever. So the games don't really need to be that big, so the effort isn't really that much, and you don't need any publisher or stuff.
But that, of course, means one thing. The competition is big. Without the support of a strong publisher, things can get pretty tough for independent game developers. To make it, the most important thing is creativity.
That's the big issue everybody has in the beginning, how to stand out. So, especially on the Apple iTunes market, there's really a lot of luck involved at first, but you can also do quite a lot of things, like try to build a little bit of hype on social platforms, Facebook, Twitter, whatever.
Christina Barleben and Björn Bernstein have a similar problem. They are finishing their studies at the Games Academy in Berlin, and with the help of some other colleagues, they've also developed a game for mobile devices. In the game, Laboratory, a rat wants to get hold of some cheese, but has to face lasers and magic boxes that teletransport it. In real life, Christina and Björn are facing some obstacles before they can get the game on the market. They are short on funding and are still new in the industry and looking for helpful contacts.
Nobody knows us right now, and this community has to consolidate somehow. That's why we make our own little videos, or we talk to people and make people remember us, because we don't have a PR department.
But they are motivated. At the end of the day, their compensation, or their cheese, so to speak, is getting to see their game being played by someone else.
It is such a nice experience to see how test players sit there and begin to smile where we wanted them to smile, when the rat gets fat and falls over because it ate the cheese.
Patrick Schindler, the co-creator of the Fish Swimming in the Ocean game for iPhone, says that for him, money also plays an important role.
If you really don't have enough money, you have to rush all your games out, or you don't have the time to do the game that you really wanted. So the money gives you freedom, and also if it's not fun, then screw the money.
Patrick's game is still not out, so he's hoping for the best. As he would say, you have to take a risk if you want to win.
Guillaume Correia de Silva there. Well, that's perhaps the lighter side of the games industry, but some say there's also a darker side. That's far more violent than fat rats falling over. The question is, how do you stand on the issue? Well, one of Australia's top police officers recently suggested that violent video games were influencing the behaviour of young people on the streets. To be precise, New South Wales Police Commissioner Andrew Scipione criticised video games for glorifying rape and murder after three teenagers were stabbed in separate incidents in Sydney. It's not the first time he's come out to highlight the social ramifications of video games, but is he right? I spoke to Police Commissioner Andrew Scipione on the line from Sydney.
Every day there are tragedies that unravel in front of us on our television screens where, you know, people have got access to firearms and shot dead tens and twenties people at a time. We know that there are issues. And of course, the one thing that I know has changed is the access that young people particularly have to these violent games where they live out their fantasies to some extent, and I think that rewires their brain to the point where they actually sometimes can't differentiate between reality and fantasy. And as I say, it might not necessarily just be young people, but they're exposed to the level of violence in movies, certainly through video games and through some of the music that they're listening to.
So what games are we talking about? What games are we talking about?
Look, there are a number of games, and what I know on the last occasion when I raised this as an issue within the Australian setting, I can assure you we believe we saw the increase in the purchase of those particular games. So I'm not of a mind to actually tell you, but I can tell you some of the behaviour that's in some of these games. When somebody glorifies players killing people and blowing things up with bombs and selling and buying drugs and robbing people and sexually assaulting or raping prostitutes, and as a result of that, they get rewarded with good health or a budget that they can spend, something's wrong.
Now, your original comments on this, say the second time you've commented on this issue, it came soon after three teenagers were apparently stabbed in separate attacks, it has to be said, in Western Sydney within the space of a short space of time. Was there any connection there between these stabbings, I should say, and violent video games?
Nothing that we'd been able to establish, but as you can imagine, these are very recent matters, and they're yet to go before courts, and that's when I'm sure we'll get more of the detail about what's actually been the driver here. But Again, it just seems that this level of violence that we are encountering, I think, must be linked to something that's happening in the minds of those young people.
I think that a lot of people would find it very difficult to disagree with what you're saying on a theoretical level, but you'll probably also agree yourself that from a legal perspective, you would have to back this up with statistics or real connections, say in a very particular case, you could say that the person admitted to being influenced by video games. And so my question is whether there is any evidence like that for you to back up your concerns.
Okay, well certainly we could do that. I think that regardless of what my concerns are, there is no way that we can resolve this unless we get the best medical research, and that's what we're talking about. Look, we have got that evidence, but it's not until we can actually get some medical linkage that we can unequivocally say, and that's the reason why. So I think it's for that reason that these discussions need to be had. We need to listen to the medical experts. We need to look at what's happening. We need to get a really good understanding of how we can prevent it. And you know, most recently, I'm aware of some of the problems that have been experienced in South Korea, where people are going into these gaming dens almost and losing track of what day it is. In there for two and 3 days.
Not feeding their children and things like that.
Not feeding their children.
Yes,
children
that.
Dying. You know, walking out to give birth to a child, disposing of the child, then walking back in and playing the games again.
So
you know, the alarm should be ringing.
So have you consulted with the games industry? What do they say, if you have?
Well, look, and the industry, I understand, the industry is in business. They're looking to sell product. Now, I'm not sure what classification process is certainly in Europe, but in Australia, there are age classifications. So certain children can't go out and buy certain games until they're able to establish their age. However, it's a bit like alcohol. We do have secondary supply issues where somebody might buy a game and it's left on a console or it's left on a computer.
But have you consulted with the industry? What do they say? Have you spoken to them about your concerns?
Well, you know, in our discussions, it's been more, I think, in prompting the discussion. Their view is that this is a nonsense, that perhaps there is no evidence, there is no connection, that there is no damage done. This is purely fantasy, and people can let go and just move on. So, you know, there are many thousands of people that would share that view. Well, there's also a view out there that says that these things are damaging us.
Andrew Scipione, Police Commissioner of the Australian State of New South Wales. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, also follow us at DW_SciTech. Why not let us know what you think about video games, and violent ones in particular? Now, we spend many hours every day sitting in front of computer screens in offices. We're constantly busy with our minds, answering emails and calls or checking social media profiles. But we're often disconnected from our bodies. As a result, many of us suffer from neck, shoulder and lower back pain, or even carpal tunnel syndrome, which affects the hands and wrists. These are symptoms of stress and too much work in the office. You can go to a physiotherapist or a psychologist, but they're each likely to only treat one or the other symptom, the pain or the stress. The Grinberg method, however, is different. The Grinberg method says that by changing your attitude to fear and pain, you can change your emotional and mental state. In the first of two parts, Cinema Nippard, who has tried Grinberg, has this report from Berlin.
Jörg Seifert is a German project manager and professional climber, and he's so fit he looks spring-loaded. But last year he started suffering from severe elbow pain, and after 6 months it led him to despair.
It was so bad I could not wash my hair or do anything with my right hand without pain. The days following any hard training, it was almost unbearably bad.
Seifert tried all his usual tactics for dealing with the pain, from extra stretching and physiotherapy to painkillers, and he even took a 5-week break, which in the past had resolved muscular pain. But the day he started climbing again, the pain was back with a vengeance.
My personal reaction to the pain was actually worse than the pain itself, because it kept me from working out hard, and it frustrated me, and it was really depressing. Also because I thought that it was not going to go away ever.
Seifert was afraid that his elbow was permanently damaged. Then a friend suggested he take part in the Grinberg Method's Chronic Pain Project in Berlin.
I thought it was rather unconventional, but everything that happened, in therapy felt like it could help. And actually, the day after, the pain was almost gone.
Other people came in suffering migraines, lower back pain, neck pain, shoulder pain, and knee pain. 3 months after the project had finished, 72% of the 180 participants reported their pain was still significantly reduced. Practitioners like Ilam Langotsky, who worked with climber Jörg Seifert, help clients identify the things that they do against pain.
For instance, every time I'm in stress, I'm holding my belly very, very tight, and then I create so much tension that it starts to disturb my physical condition in this area. So I'm trying to show the person, yes, this is what you're doing, and now please hold it more. Please learn how your muscles are doing this, in order for you then to notice how to stop doing it.
The Grinberg method was founded by Israeli Avi Grinberg in the 1980s. He trained as a nurse and studied many different disciplines, from reflexology and yoga to martial arts. After working with people suffering chronic health problems for a number of years, Grinberg began asking a different set of questions. Here's Langotsky again.
Which kind of tools should we give people? Which kind of discipline should they train in order to get better? And how can they take back the responsibility over their bodies into their own hands while the practitioner is actually guiding them rather than healing them?
While athletes like Jörg Seifert tend to be more in tune with their bodies, the rest of us often ignore our everyday aches and pains, a lot of which are caused by our sedentary lifestyles and work practices. A recent study by the Australian National University and Sydney University found that people who sit for more than 8 hours a day have a 15% greater risk of early death. Grinberg practitioner Emily Poole says we need to pay more attention to how we're treating our bodies.
It's crazy to only do small, fast movements with your eyes looking at a screen and none of the rest gets to move. And then we ignore the neck pain, we ignore the carpal tunnel syndrome, we ignore the lower back pain, and even treat it in ways that also come from the mind, that we would rather take painkillers often than change our position or do more physical activity.
Since taking a few Grinberg sessions myself for shoulder pain, I've started to take a break from work every 2 hours to stretch and go for a quick walk. Sometimes I also put my laptop on a box so that I can stand up to work instead of ignoring the fact that my legs are going to sleep and my shoulder is getting sore again. And I have to admit that I have noticed a difference. Verid Manasse is a practitioner and teacher who runs the Grinberg School in Berlin with Claudia Glovik.
Many times what we see that when people are really managing to stop everything around the pain, not only the pain itself has been reduced, but all other subjects of the person's life being affected also. It affects the relationship and it affects the way they sleep. So it becomes a much bigger subject than having pain or not having pain.
The truth is we're happier when we're free of pain and generally nicer people to be around. If we become aware of how we relate to pain, as Grinberg suggests, it might just help us to break out of some bad old habits.
Cinnamon nippered there, and next week we'll be looking at how the Grinberg method wants you to relate to fear. Now, here's something that knows exactly how to frighten a lot of people. That's loud music. Not me, it has to be said, but then loud is relative. We often hear people saying that they think contemporary music doesn't compare to the sound of the 60s and the 70s or even the 80s, and they're often laughed at the bar at the same time. But now it's official. Scientists in Spain say they have pinpointed how the sound of pop music has changed over the past 50 years, and by that they mean it's less dynamic and a lot louder. Guy Hedgeco in Madrid has been bopping his head and has the details.
Music isn't what it used to be. These days it's loud and it all sounds the same. No, really, even scientists are saying it now. Or at least one group of scientists here in Spain. Joan Serra, an expert in artificial intelligence at the National Research Council in Barcelona, has carried out an exhaustive study of popular music from the past 50 years, looking at how its sound has developed. He and his team examined nearly 500,000 songs, focusing mainly on pop and rock, but also including the genres of folk, metal, hip-hop and dance music. Using algorithms, they analysed numerical descriptions of songs, having broken them down into small chunks, each lasting no more than a beat.
What we do is to analyze these songs by computers. These data are numbers which can be processed by a computer or several computers in parallel, and just counting and seeing which transitions happen and which not is easy for a computer and fast.
Serra found that between the eras of Elvis Presley and Lady Gaga, there have been notable changes in the sound of pop music. For one thing, it's got louder. That is, the average volume at which recordings are made in the studio has risen, with less use of low volume for dynamic effect.
The loudness thing is very clear, and this is interesting because many people was talking about that, but until now we didn't have enough scientific evidence to prove or to show that.
But he's also found that over the past 5 decades, there has been less and less variety of sound in music, both in terms of pitch or use of notes, and also what the experts call timbre, which is the richness of music's instrumentation, its colour. Serra points out that the best way to compare the difference in sound between yesterday's pop and that of today is to listen to 2 renditions of the same song. Remember this? It's the Lambada, a big hit from the 80s. And here's its present-day counterpart, Jennifer Lopez's On the Floor, which borrows heavily from the Lambada.
La Lambada is a quite old song that has been covered many, many times by many artists. Jennifer Lopez follows it because it's just one part of the song that she takes. The other part is completely new and it's completely monotonous.
So scientists say pop music is louder and less sonically varied than it used to be. But what about those who make the music? Surely from a producer's point of view, being loud is what it's all about. Even if just to cut through all the other sounds on the radio and that fill our busy lives. Maybe, but not always.
Hello, Osvaldo.
Hello, welcome to Red Bull Studio.
Osvaldo Terrones is the sound engineer at Red Bull Studios in Madrid. He's engineered and produced recordings for dozens of bands. He says the scientists are correct, and the loudness issue in particular is something that worries him.
It's getting worse, and any producer wants to be louder than the other one. I don't know why, but it's really bad, because it's about compression, and compression is about cutting the dynamic range. So for me, and I think for everyone, the dynamic range is the most important thing in the music.
Terrones also thinks that for the most part, the sonic creativity of the 60s and 70s, when the likes of the Beatles, the Beach Boys and Pink Floyd reigned supreme, has faded. And the culprit, he says, is technology, with artists and producers relying too much on the amazing technical possibilities at their disposal, rather than focusing on the music itself.
If you have a lot of tools and materials, technically, I think you can't develop your imagination. And I think music is about imagination. It's about going far away from here. And if you are holding this technology, you can't go far.
Perhaps someday pop music will reach a ceiling of volume and monotony, leading to an audio backlash of rich sound and dynamics. In the meantime, those of us who complain that music isn't what it used to be can at least rest assured that for once we're right. Guy Hedgeco, DW, Madrid.
Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. Listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfa Karabani. Studio tech was Claudia Rack. Next week, doping at the Paralympics. Hope you can make it then. Until then, thanks for listening and bye for now.